3. The guards met Kel at the mouth of Narish Kas as planned. Staff, with his barrel chest and silvering temples and beard, and Hastra, young and cheerful, with a sun-warmed complexion and a crown of dark curls. "At least he's pretty," Rai had said months ago on seeing the new guards. The prince had been sulking because his own set, Tolnus and Vis, had neither looks nor humor. "Gentlemen," said Kel as his coat settled around him in the alley. The guards looked cold, and he wondered how long they'd been waiting for him. "I would have brought you a hot drink, but..." He held up his empty hands, as if to say, "rules."
"'S okay, Master Kel,"
said Hastra, through clenched teeth, missing the jab. Staff, on the other hand, said nothing. They had the decency not to search him then and there, but rather turned and fell silently in step behind him as he set off in the direction of the palace. He could see the eyes drifting toward their small procession. Any chance at blending in ruined by the presence of the royal guards flanking him in their gleaming armor and red cloaks. Kel would have preferred subterfuge, the suspicion of being followed, to the actuality. But he straightened his shoulders and held his head high and tried to remind himself that he looked like a royal, even if he felt like a prisoner. He hadn't even done anything wrong, not today. And saints knew he'd had the chance. Several chances. At last they reached the palace steps, strewn even now with frost-dusted flowers. "The king?" Kel asked as they strode through the entryway. Staff led the way to a chamber where King Maxim stood near a blazing hearth, in conversation with several Ostra. When he saw Kel, he dismissed them. Kel kept his head up, but none of the attendants met his gaze. When they were gone, the king nodded him forward. Kel continued into the middle of the room before spreading his arms for Staff and Hastra in a gesture that was as much challenge as invitation.
"Don't be dramatic," said Maxim.
The guards had the decency to look uncertain as they came forward. "Rai must be rubbing off on me, Your Majesty," said Kel grimly as Staff helped him out of his coat and Hastra patted down his shirt and trousers and ran a hand around the lip of his boots. He didn't have anything on his person, and they wouldn't be able to find anything in his coat, not unless he wanted it to be found. He sometimes worried that the coat had a mind of its own. The only other person who'd ever managed to find what they wanted in its pockets was Lila. He'd never found out how she'd done that. Traitorous coat. Staff withdrew the Grey London letter from one of the pockets and delivered it to the king before handing the coat back to Kel.
"How was the king?"
asked Maxim, taking the letter. "Dead," said Kel. That caught the man off guard. He recounted his visit, and the Prince Regent's, now George IV's, renewed interest in magic. He even mentioned that the new king had tried to bribe him, taking care to emphasize the fact that he'd declined the offer. Maxim stroked his beard and looked troubled, but he said nothing, only waved a hand to show Kel that he was dismissed. He turned, feeling his mood darken, but as Staff and Hastra moved to follow, Maxim called them back.
"Leave him be,"
he said, and Kel was grateful for that small kindness as he escaped to his rooms. His relief didn't last. When he reached the doors to his chamber, he found two more guards standing outside them. They were Rai's.
"Saints, I swear you just keep multiplying," he muttered.
"Sir,"
said Tolnus.
"Nothing,"
grumbled Kel, pushing past them. There was only one reason Tolnus and Vis would be stationed outside his door. He found Rai standing in the middle of his room, his back to Kel as he considered himself in a full-length mirror. From this angle, Kel couldn't see Rai's face, and for a moment a memory surged into his mind of Rai waiting for him to wake. Only it hadn't been Rai, of course, but Astrid, wearing his skin, and they were in Rai's chambers then, not his. But for an instant, the details blurred, and he found himself searching Rai for any pendants or charms, searching his floor for blood, before the past crumbled back into memory.
"About time," said Rai,
and Kel was secretly relieved when the voice that came from Rai's lips was undoubtedly his brother's.
"What brings you to my room?"
he asked, relief bleeding into annoyance.
"Adventure, intrigue, brotherly concern. Or," continued the prince lazily, "perhaps I'm just giving your mirror something to look at besides your constant pout."
Kel frowned and Rai smiled.
"Ah, there it is, that famous scowl."
"I don't scowl," rumbled Kel.
Rai shot a conspiratorial look at his own reflection. Kel sighed and tossed his coat onto the nearest couch before heading for the alcove off his chamber.
"What are you doing?"
Rai called after.
"Hold on,"
Kel called back, shutting the door between them. A single candle flickered to life, and by its light he saw the symbols drawn on the wood. There, amid the other marks and fresh with blood, was the doorway to Dissan, the way to Windsor Castle. Kel reached out and rubbed at the mark until it was obscured and then gone. When Kel returned, Rai was sitting in Kel's favorite chair, which he'd dragged around so it was facing the room instead of the balcony doors.
"What was that about?"
he asked, head resting in his hand.
"That's my chair," said Kel flatly. "Battered old thing," said Rai, knowing how fond Kel was of it.
The prince had mischief in his pale gold eyes as he got to his feet.
"I'm still nursing a headache," said Kel. "So if you're here to force me on another outing..." "That's not why I'm here,"
said Rai, crossing to the sideboard. He started to pour himself a drink, and Kel was about to say something very unkind when he saw that it was simply tea. He nodded at one of the sofas.
"Sit down."
Kel would have stood out of spite, but he was weary from the trip, and he sank onto the nearest sofa. Rai finished fixing his tea and sat down opposite.
"Well," prompted Kel. "I thought Tyrion was supposed to teach you patience," chided Rai.
He set the tea on the table and drew a wooden box from underneath.
"I wanted to apologize."
"For what?" asked Kel.
"The lying, the drinking, the fighting, the relentless..."
But something in Rai's expression made him stop. The prince raked the black curls from his face, and Kel realized that he looked older. Not old. Rai was only 20, a year and a half younger than Kel. But the edges of his face had sharpened, and his bright eyes were less amazed, more intense. He'd grown up, and Kel couldn't help but wonder if it was all natural, the simple, inevitable progression of time, or if the last dregs of his youth had been stripped away by what had happened.
"Look," said the prince, "I know things have been hard, harder these past months than ever, and I know I've only made it worse.
Rai," the prince held up his hand to silence him,
"I've been difficult."
"So have I," admitted Kel.
"You really have."
Kel found himself chuckling, but shook his head.
"One life is a hard thing to keep hold of, Rai. Two is..." "We'll find our stride," insisted the prince,
and then he shrugged.
"Or you'll get us both killed."
"How can you say that with such levity?" snapped Kel, straightening.
"Kel,"
Rai sat forward, elbows on his knees.
"I was dead."
The words hung in the air between them.
"I was dead," he said again, "and you brought me back. You have already given me something I shouldn't have."
A shadow flashed across his face when he said it, there and then gone.
"If it were lost again," he went on, "I would still have lived twice. This is all borrowed."
"No," said Kel sternly, "it is bought and paid for."
"For how long?"
countered Rai.
"You cannot measure out what you have purchased. I am grateful for the life you've bought me, though I hate the cost. But what do you plan to do, Kel? Live forever?"
"I don't want that."
Kel frowned.
"You would rather die?"
Rai looked tired.
"Death comes for us all, brother. You cannot hide from it forever. We will die one day, you and I.
And this doesn't frighten you?
Rai shrugged.
Not nearly as much as the idea of wasting a perfectly good life in fear of it.
And to that end, he nudged the box toward Kel.
What is it?
A peace offering. A present. Happy birthday.
Kel frowned.
My birthday is not for another month.
Rai took up his tea.
Don't be ungrateful, just take it.
Kel drew the box onto his knees and lifted the lid. Inside, a face stared up at him. It was a helmet, made of a single piece of metal that curved from the chin over the top of the head and down to the base of the skull. A break formed the mouth and arched the nose, and a brow-like visor hid the wearer's eyes. Aside from this subtle shaping, the mask's markings were a pair of decorative wings, one above each ear.
"Am I going into battle?" asked Kel, confused. "Of a sort," said Rai. "It's your mask. For the tournament."
Kel nearly dropped the helmet.
"The Essentosh? Have you lost your mind?"
Rai shrugged.
"I don't think so. Not unless you've lost yours."
He paused.
"Do you think it works that way? I mean, I suppose it..." "I'm an Antari,"
Kel cut in, struggling to keep his voice down.
"I'm the adopted son of the Maresh Crown, the strongest magician in the Arnesian Empire, possibly in the world..."
"Careful, Kel. Your ego is showing..."
"And you want me to compete in an inter-empire tournament?"
"Obviously, the great and powerful Kel can't compete," said Rai. "That would be like rigging the game. It could start a war."
"Exactly."
"Which is why you'll be in disguise." Kel groaned, shaking his head.
"This is insane, Rai.
And even if you were crazy enough to think it could work, Tyrion would never allow it."
"Oh, he didn't. Not at first. He fought me tooth and nail. Called it madness. Called us fools. It wasn't even my idea.
But in the end, he understood that approving of something and allowing it are not always the same thing."
Kel's eyes narrowed. "Why would Tyrion change his mind?"
Rai swallowed.
"Because I told him the truth."
"And what's that?"
"That you needed it."
"Rai, that we needed it." He grimaced a little when he said it. Kel hesitated, meeting his brother's gaze.
"What do you mean?"
Rai shoved himself up from the chair.
"You're not the only one who wants to crawl out of their skin, Kel," he said, pacing. "I see the way this confinement is wearing on you."
He tapped his chest.
"I feel it. You spend hours training in the basin with no one to fight, and you have not been at peace a single day since Holland, since the Danes, since the Black Knight. And if you want the honest truth, unless you find some release..."
Rai stopped pacing.
"I'll end up strangling you myself."
Kel winced and looked down at the mask in his lap. He ran his fingers over the smooth silver. It was simple and elegant, the silver polished to such a shine that it was nearly a mirror. His reflection stared back at him, distorted. It was madness, and it frightened him how badly he wanted to agree to it. But he couldn't. He set the mask on the sofa.
"It's too dangerous."
"Not if we're careful," insisted his brother.
"We're tethered to each other, Rai. My pain becomes your pain.
I'm well aware of our condition."
"Then you know I can't. I won't."
"I am not only your brother," said Rai.
"I am your prince, and I command it. You will compete in the Essentosh. You will burn off some of this fire before it spreads."
"And what about our bond?
If I get hurt,
then I will share your pain," said Rai levelly.
"You say that now, but..."
"Kel,
my greatest fear in life isn't dying. It's being the source of someone else's suffering. I know you feel trapped. I know I'm your cage. And I can't..."
His voice broke, and Kel could feel his brother's pain. Everything he tried to smother until dark and drown until morning.
"You will do this," said Rai. "For me. For both of us." Kel held his brother's gaze.
All right, he said.
Rye's features faltered, and then he broke into a smile. Unlike the rest of his face, his grin was as boyish as ever.
You will?
Kel felt a thrill go through him as he took up the mask again.
I will.
But if I'm not competing as myself, he said, then who will I be?
Rye reached into the box and withdrew from among the wrappings a scroll of paper Kel hadn't noticed. He held it out, and when Kel unfurled it, he saw the Arnesian roster. 12 names, the men and women representing their empire. There was Kisimir, of course, as well as Alucard. A thrill ran through Kel at the thought of having an excuse to fight him. He skimmed past them, searching.
I picked out your name myself, said Rye. You'll be competing as
Kamarov Lost, answered Kel, reading the 7th name aloud. Of course. K.L. The letters carved into the knife he wore on his forearm. The only things that had come with him from his previous life, whatever it was. Those letters had become his name. K.L. K.L. Kel. But how many nights had he spent wondering what they stood for? How many nights had he dreamed up names for himself?
Oh, come on, chided Rye, misreading Kel's tension for annoyance. It's a good name. Rather princely, if I do say so.
It'll do, said Kel, fighting back a smile as he set the scroll aside.
Well,
said Rye, taking up the helmet and holding it out to Kel,
try it on.
Kel hesitated. The prince's voice was light, the invitation casual. But there was more to the gesture, and they both knew it. If Kel put on the mask, this would cease to be a stupid, harmless idea and become something more, something real. He reached out and took the helmet.
I hope it fits, said Rye. You've always had a big head.
Kel slipped the helmet on, standing as he did. The inside was soft, the fit made snug by the padding. The visor cut all the way from ear to ear, so his vision and hearing were both clear.
How do I look?
He asked, his voice muffled slightly by the metal.
See for yourself, said Rye, nodding at the mirror.
Kel turned toward the glass. It was eerie, the polished metal creating an almost tunneling reflection, and the cut of the visor hid his gaze so that even though he could see fine, no one would be able to see that one of his eyes was blue and the other black.
I'm going to stand out, he said.
It's the Essentosh, said Rye. Everyone stands out.
And while it was true that everyone wore masks, and it was part of the drama, the tradition, this wasn't just a mask.
Most competitors don't dress as though they're going to war.
Rye crossed his arms and gave him an appraising look.
Yes, well, most competitors don't truly need to maintain their anonymity, but your features are unique.
Are you calling me ugly? Rye snorted.
We both know you're the prettiest boy at the ball.
Kel couldn't stop cheating glances in the mirror. The silver helmet hovered over his simple black clothes, but something was missing. His coat was still draped on the back of the couch. He took it up and shook it slightly as he turned it inside out, and as he did, his usual black jacket with silver buttons became something else, something new.
I've never seen that one before, said Rye.
Neither had Kel, not until a few days earlier when he'd gotten bored and decided to see what other sides the coat had tucked away. Now and then, unused outfits seemed to disappear, new ones turning up in their place. Kel had wondered at the sudden appearance of this one, so unlike the others, but now, as he shrugged it on, he realized that was because this coat didn't belong to him. It belonged to Kamarov. The coat was knee-length and silver, trimmed in a patterned border of black and lined with blood-red silk. The sleeves were narrow, and the bottom flared, the collar high enough to reach the base of his skull. Kel slipped the coat on, fastening the clasps, which cut an asymmetrical line from shoulder to hip. Rye had gone rooting around in Kell's closet, and now he re-emerged with a silver walking stick. He tossed it, and Kell plucked it out of the air, his fingers curled around the black lion's head that shaped the handle. And then he turned back to his reflection.
"Well, Master Lost," said Rye, stepping back, "you do look splendid."
Kell didn't recognize the man in the mirror, and not simply because the mask hid his face. No, it was his posture, too. Shoulders straight and head up, his gaze level behind the visor. Kamarov Lost was an impressive figure. A breeze wove gently around him, ruffling his coat. Kell smiled.
"About that," said Rye, referring to the swirling air. "For obvious reasons, Kamarov can't be an Antari. I suggest you pick an element and stick with it. Two, if you must. I've heard there are quite a few duels this year, but triads are rare enough to draw attention."
"Mm-hmm," said Kell, adjusting his pose.
"While I'm sympathetic to your sudden bout of narcissism," said Rye, "this is important, Kell. When you're wearing that mask, you cannot be the most powerful magician in Arns."
"I understand." Kell tugged the helmet back off and struggled to smooth his hair. "Rye," he said, "are you certain?" His heart was racing. He wanted this. He shouldn't want this. It was a terrible idea. But he wanted it all the same. Kell's blood sang at the idea of a fight. A good fight. Rye nodded.
"All right, then. So you've come to your senses?"
Kell shook his head, dazed. "Or lost my mind." But he was smiling now, so hard he felt his face might crack. He turned the helmet over and over in his hands. And then, as suddenly as his spirits had soared, they sank.
"Sanked!" he cursed, sagging back onto the couch. "What about my guards?" "Silver and gold?" asked Rye, his pet names for the men. "What about them?"
"I can't exactly ditch Stoff and Hastra for the entire length of the tournament, nor can I conveniently misplace them for each and every bout."
"I'm sorry, I thought you were a master magician."
Kell threw up his hands. "It has nothing to do with my skill, Rye. There's suspicious, and then there's obvious."
"Well then," said the prince, "we'll just have to tell them."
"And they'll tell the king. And do you want to guess what the king will do? Because I'm willing to bet he won't risk the stability of the kingdom so I can let off some steam." Rye pinched the bridge of his nose. Kell frowned. That gesture. It didn't suit the prince. It was something he would do, had done 100 times.
"Leave it to me," he said.
He crossed to Kell's doors and swung them open, leaning against the frame. Kell hoped the guards had truly stayed behind when he left King Maxim, but they must have only granted him a berth, because Rye called them in, closing the door before his own guards could follow. Kell rose to his feet, unsure what his brother meant to do.
"Staff," said Rye, addressing the man with silver temples, "when my father assigned you to Chateau Kell, what did he say?"
Staff looked from Kell to Rye as if it were a trap, a trick question.
"Well, he said we were to watch, and to keep him from harm, and to report to His Majesty if we saw Master Kell doing anything suspicious."
Kell scowled, but Rye flashed an encouraging smile.
"Is that so, Hastra?"
The guard with dark gold hair bowed his head.
"Yes, Your Highness."
"But if you were informed about something in advance, then it wouldn't be suspicious, would it?" Hastra looked up.
No, Your Highness."
"Rye," protested Kell, but the prince held up his hand.
"You both swore your lives to this family, this crown, and this empire. Does your oath hold?"
Both men bowed their heads and brought their hands to their chests.
"Of course, Your Highness," they said, almost in unison.
"What on earth is Rye getting at?" wondered Kell. And then the prince's countenance changed. The easiness fell away, as did his cheerful smile. His posture straightened, and his jaw clenched, and in that moment he looked less like a prince than a future king. He looked like Maxim.
"Then understand this," he said, his voice now low and stern.
What I'm about to tell you regards the safety and security of not only our family, but of the Arnesian Empire.
The men's eyes went wide with concern. Kell's narrowed.
We believe there is a threat in the tournament. Rai shot Kell a knowing look, though Kell honestly had no idea where he was going with this. In order to determine the nature of this threat, Kell will be competing in the Essentosh disguised as an ordinary entrant, Kamarov Lost.
The guards frowned, cheating looks toward Kell, who managed a stiff nod.
The secrecy of my identity, he cut in, is paramount. If either Pharaoh or Vesk discovers my involvement, they'll assume we've rigged the game.
My father already knows of Kell's inclusion, added Rai.
He has his own matters to attend to. If you see anything during the tournament, you will tell Kell himself or me.
But how are we supposed to guard him? Asked Staff. If he's pretending to be someone else.
Rai didn't miss a beat.
One of you will pose as his second. Every competitor needs an attendant, and the other will continue to guard him from a safe distance.
I've always wanted to be in a plot, whispered Hostra,
and then, raising his voice,
Your Highness, could I be the one in disguise?
His eagerness was a barely contained thing. Rai looked to Kell, who nodded. Hostra beamed, and Rai brought his hands together in a soft, decisive clap.
So it's settled. As long as Kell is Kell, you will guard him with your usual attentiveness. But when dealing with Kamarov, the illusion must be flawless, the secret held.
The two guards nodded solemnly and were dismissed.
Saints, thought Kell as the doors swung shut. He's actually done it.
There, said Rai, slouching onto the couch. That wasn't so hard.
Kell looked at his brother with a mixture of surprise and awe.
You know, he said, taking up the mask, if you can rule half as well as you can lie, you're going to make an incredible king.
Rai's smile was a dazzling thing.
Thank you.